WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Few people have watched more television in their lifetime than our TV critic David Bianculli, and he is unapologetic. In fact, he thinks people who dismiss TV as shallow are not only missing some excellent programs, but they're depriving themselves of some important shared cultural experiences. He made his case for TV in his book, Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Now in his new book, Dictionary of Teleliteracy, he's chosen and written about the 500 most memorable programs and televised events from 1945 to 1995. David was born 8 years after his book begins in 1953. He writes that the most important contribution television has made to American society was the coverage of the Kennedy assassination and funeral.
I think that galvanized us as a nation through television, and it was probably the most important, not probably, it was the most important event that I think anyone who was alive at the time ever was able to see on television. And for that whole stretch from getting news about the assassination until a couple of days afterwards and then the stunning, you know, Oswald being shot by Ruby, what you had there was the whole country watching history unfold live. And I think that it was part of not only the educational process and the emotional process, but the grieving process specifically.
What's a favorite TV show from your childhood that you included in your teleliteracy dictionary?
Bullwinkle Show is probably a major guilty pleasure, except that it's not really guilty.
Oh, how can it be a guilty pleasure when you're a kid?
I mean, even when I'm an adult, and you know, one of the first things I had to do as a parent was try and figure out exactly how best to wean my kids on Bullwinkle so that they wouldn't think it was too old and too weird.
And since you mentioned Bullwinkle, I want to sneak a little factoid into the discussion, which is the voice of one of the voices on Bullwinkle is also the voice of an unseen character on a famous program from the 50s. Why don't you tell us who that is?
Well, if you're talking about the character of, I mean, William Conrad.
Oh, didn't even know about this.
Bullwinkle's just full of famous people. William Conrad, who later went on to do Canon and on radio was the voice of Jim Arness in Gunsmoke. Oh, see, once you start talking specifically, it's helpless. You may as well just leave the room.
Okay, the factoid I was thinking of is that Paul Frees, the voice of Boris Badenov, was the voice of the millionaire on the TV series The Millionaire.
See?
Something I learned from your book.
Okay, well, there you go. To leave the other one not hanging, William Conrad was the guy who did that breathless, rocky narration, which may be where I learned how to speak. You know, just get it all out as fast as you possibly can. But that was William Conrad. And every time he did the narration, they told him, do it faster, do it faster, do it faster.
When I was growing up, I loved watching Westerns, and there were so many of them at the time. Going back and rewatching some of the Westerns and thinking about them to write your entries, which do you think are the ones that really hold up the best and had the most impact on television?
I think Gunsmoke, not only because it was the granddaddy and probably will always be the granddaddy in terms of the number of years. I think it was a 20-year stretch. No other entertainment program is going to get 20 years. And when you go back and watch the very first Gunsmoke, I hope this doesn't sound sexist, but what really surprised me was Miss Kitty, 20 years, I mean, at the very beginning of Gunsmoke, was such a sexual character that by the time I got around to watching Gunsmoke, although you knew that there was that chemistry between Matt Dillon and Miss Kitty, you had a feeling it was based on a long history as much as anything else. But they were both very vibrant and young and good-looking at the beginning, and it was much more flirtatious than I expected. But Gunsmoke, because it was also a very well-written show, and the one that I guess my favorite out of that whole stretch was Have Gun, Will Travel. I just found that to be a very dark program. And even when I was young, I gravitated towards things that were unusual. Hardly a surprise, huh?
Rawhide, thankfully, gets an entry in your book. And I think it's a show I really loved when I was young. And, you know, Clint Eastwood got his start on that program. Does it hold up?
Certainly Eastwood does. And you can tell that he's not a very good actor at the time, but that he's got something in the episodes that you watch with him. But Rawhide itself, the best thing about that, that one and Wagon Train both, took a lot of care to do little things. They were almost like Seinfeld Westerns. They weren't these giant plots. And it was funny. I mean, Wagon Train, it was about, you know, how tough life is, how tough life was back then, you know, and look, we can't even wash our pots. We can't go across here. And it wasn't all giant confrontations.
Are there any programs in your Dictionary of Teleliteracy that are programs from the 70s or 80s that you were really uninterested in or dismissive of in their time, and in retrospect seem like, for better or worse, they really had quite an impact on what followed?
Happy Days, I guess, and Laverne and Shirley I dismissed so completely at the time, but both because Gary Marshall's body of work since then as a creator of those shows and subsequently as a film director, and then the talent that came out of there. When you see those in retrospect, they hold up better than the Norman Lear comedies of the same period, which were so revered at the time. You take away All in the Family, which was truly groundbreaking, and programs like One Day at a Time and all but a handful of episodes of Maude are, to me, as dated as Brady Bunch outfits.
How are they dated?
They strive so hard. It's sort of like watching the genesis of political correctness being bubbled up out of television.
My guest is TV critic David Bianculli. He has a new book called Dictionary of Teleliteracy. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with our TV critic David Bianculli. He's written a Dictionary of Teleliteracy. Your book, in a way, leads us back to the roots of some of the programs and trends that we see on television. Now, for example, you know, watching hearings and Congress has become so popular on C-SPAN, but in the 50s, one of the big shows was the Army McCarthy hearings.
Right.
Which, of course, you have an entry for.
And the Kefauver Crime Commission hearings, all of these things where that was the only place to see that stuff. And political conventions from 52 on. For a while, that was broadcast mainstream television because there was nothing but broadcast mainstream television. And you see a lot of these things that were part of the early years of television that have just been adapted and maintained throughout, you know, sitcoms, variety shows, news programs, and others that have either gone to the fringes of television or else come from the fringes. I mean, when I was a kid, the only place you could watch tennis was on public television. And that's certainly changed. But on the other hand, it seems like almost the only place you can watch politics these days, practice live, is to have cable.
Did any connections become clearer to you from writing this book? Did you think, like, oh, I really didn't realize that this show had a predecessor in the 1950s?
A lot of them. And I mean, it was really gratifying to go back, for example, and see shows like the Jack Benny program and to see how clearly it was a forerunner of Seinfeld. And so to be able to put that in a context that maybe because Jack Benny's been around so long, people wouldn't do.
In what respect is it a forerunner of Seinfeld?
Everything is just about the same. If you go back and look at an old Jack Benny program, it begins and, you know, he addresses the audience, and the rest of it is all just about little things. And there's a core of crazy people, you don't know why and how they stay together, and he obsesses about the little things and goes out and, you know, an episode is built around him shopping, you know, at a grocery store. Now that sounds like Seinfeld, but it was also Jack Benny.
Your idea of teleliteracy is in part about having a shared culture of television.
Mm-hmm.
But are you saying, too, that you think that you want people to watch television in a different way?
Oh, yeah, because I think that if the way I watch television, by looking forward to my favorite shows, knowing when they're on, by doing research about the types of things that are coming up, looking over the schedules, is a normal way that people watch movies or anything else because they're spending money there. But TV, I'm afraid that most people say, well, it's 8 o'clock, let's turn on the tube and go through channel surfing the remote and see what's on. You know, if you look first, you can say, well, here's something I'd really like to either see or tape. It's going to be on at 10 o'clock on some obscure channel, or this is my favorite show and I'll tape that. But not just turn it on just to watch the appliance. I'd rather have people stack up things that they liked and when they want to watch TV to put on something that they haven't seen.
See, I spend a lot of my TV time watching The Appliance. Yeah, because I don't have time often to watch a whole program.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I do have the time to put on the TV, I just like channel surf, want to see what's on. And, you know, so I can spend endless time just going round and round and round the dial.
Well, I can understand that at certain day parts. Like late night TV, if you're going to be watching a Letterman or you're going to be watching a Snyder or anything like that where you know it's coming out live and you can slip in and out in 10, 15 minutes, you get a sense that you're watching what everybody else is watching. But otherwise, what you ought to do is say, okay, I really like Homicide. I just never get a chance to watch it, tape Homicide, and even watch it 10, 15 minutes at a time.
Too logical.
Nobody does it. I mean, then the next thing you're going to ask people to do, then what you have is a whole stack of tapes that you not only don't watch,
right,
but then you get really annoyed because those shows are then repeated before you get a chance to watch them.
No,
and you
exactly
realize how futile it all is. There's too much television.
How old were you when you got a TV in your own room and you could watch TV by yourself and it wasn't this like family social event?
Oh, college.
Right.
I mean, we had one TV set and it was on rollers and it was in the living room. And you could occasionally, when everybody else went to bed, pull it into your room, but only if nobody else was watching it. My older sister used to torture me. I remember specifically my favorite program at one time was The Avengers. She would roll it into her bedroom, lock the door like 2 minutes before The Avengers was on, and then watch the whole thing screaming about how good it was while I was on the other side.
Now, what were the TV shows that you and your parents would fight about or you and your sister would fight about because you wanted to watch it and they wanted to watch something else?
I guess the biggest battle was always about Bonanza versus Smothers Brothers, that first season. And it wasn't that either one of them was a bad show. It was just I really wanted to see the Smothers Brothers. And while my dad really liked them too, we'd been watching Bonanza for so long that that was sort of a habit. So the way we solved that one was we would, you know, when I think of this, it's just so geeky. We would play chess. And because we always would play chess while we watched TV, you know. We weren't just sitting there droning on. And we would actually, whoever won the chess game or the 2 out of 3 match or whatever it was, would get to say what the next program was going to be. So that was how we settled debates.
Well, that's actually fairly democratic as opposed to the parents deciding because they were the parents.
Right. It's democratic, but it's also there's no way I know what image I'm drawing up, and I just hope I don't seem quite so geeky as that.
That's right. The nerdy Bianculli family
right. Right.
Would play an intellectual game of chess to decide whether to watch Bonanza or not.
Yeah.
David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. His new book, Dictionary of Teleliteracy, is published by Continuum.